You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca. This is the Made of Clay Report, digging deeper into the issues that make and break our lives. And our guest on this hour is Pete Myers. Welcome, Pete.
Thanks, Eric. Thanks for having me on your show. I think this is a fantastic show you got.
Good, good. I'm glad. And it's good to have you. We've known each other for probably, what, 15 or?
You've been like here 12, 13 12, years.
Almost as long as you've been in Ithaca.
Yeah.
Because I remember working on some Jubilee debt reduction and repeal the Rockefeller drug laws kinds of things together over the years, in addition to the Workers' Center related issues.
Right.
Yeah. So I've just given you my connections to you historically. The way we start the show is with a kind of a thumbnail sketch. You know, what in a few sentences kind of captures the mosaic of your life so that can be kind of the beginning of our conversation?
Well, that's a really good question. I think growing up in South Bend, Indiana, in a lower middle class, working class background, feeling a certain... Yeah, a strong amount of alienation growing up in South Bend, and moving to New York City in 1984 when I was 24 years old was a real formative experience for me. Lived there for 10 years, moved back to Indiana. I'm kind of giving you more of a timeline.
Yeah. But it's a sketch.
Yeah. I think probably looking at issues of class issues and race issues and privilege issues has really defined my adult life ever since having actually lived in Brooklyn, and it kind of informs what I do right now as well.
Brooklyn made you aware of what you went through in South Bend even more so. Is that what you're trying to say?
Yeah, and it was kind of like my first adult work experience, working in a high school as a drug counselor and just, seeing all the relative privilege that I had and kind of catapulted me into my later adult years.
Wow. And that makes even more poignant the choice of your first song, which is a Beatles song, Within You, Without You.
Yeah, it's not one of their more well-known songs. It's actually on the Sgt. Pepper album, and it kind of is, another thing that defines me is my spirituality. I mean, I'm very much, I meditate, and, it's kind of like I'm discovering more and more that I'm not who I thought I was, and reality isn't what I thought it was. And I thought, I think for me, this song really captures that.
And in ways that's more and less.
Yes.
Cool. So we're going to play from Sgt. Pepper's Within You, Without You by the Beatles.
Life goes on within you and without you.
and that was Within You, Without You, from Sgt. Pepper's by the Beatles. So our guest on this hour is Pete Myers. Pete, what was a defining moment in your young life that helped kind of propel you to where you are now?
Well, actually, we had talked about this while the song was going on. Sure. I want to actually go there's so many defining moments in life.
Yeah, yeah.
But
yeah.
A defining moment actually took place in fifth grade and connects to
this right now. This goes back even earlier.
Yeah. Fifth grade, I don't know, I might have been, however you are, how old?
You're about 10 years or
10 years.
10 going on 11 in fifth grade, I think.
So I'm going to school in South Bend, Indiana, to elementary school, public school, mm-hmm. and I was in this class, and myself and this black girl named Tammy Hampton, basically she was writing on the board Pete and Andrea, you know, like how kids do, and I was writing on the board Tammy and Donald, and we got into a slap fight with each other. She was bigger than me. We got into a slap fight with each other, and the teacher walked in, he was a white male, and immediately fingered her as being the perpetrator for this fight. Uh-oh. And not me, and she got into trouble, got paddled. Paddling was, corporal punishment was very big in Indiana back then. It may still now,
probably not, but yeah.
Maybe not, but so she got into trouble and I didn't. And that was a real defining moment for me in the sense of realizing, why am I not getting into trouble and why is she? And, you know, I didn't give it a great deal of thought. I was just happy at that moment that I wasn't getting into trouble.
Right,
So, you know, that kind of propelled me into kind of just like thinking subtly about those issues growing up. Mm-hmm. But then I went to college in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and got a master's degree in psychology, actually an unusual program at Duquesne University called Existential Phenomenology. And immediately after getting that degree in 83, I moved to Brooklyn, mm-hmm. New York, and got a job almost right away as a drug counselor in a Coney Island high school. And it was just, you know, I worked in this job for 4 years, and I really began to realize that this was it's at the school, for those listening from New York City, school is called Grady Technical Vocational High School, right across from Lincoln High School on Coney Island. And it was primarily boys, Latino, African-American, and a few Italians. Mm-hmm. And it was just, I really realized, like, how much privilege I had in working with the kids that I was working with. And, you know, these were kids, you know, I had five kids in my 4 years that I was there that were killed in some sort of violence. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I saw a lot of violence in the school. And it just, you know, it kind of was always a scary experience for me in some ways, but I developed a really strong relationship with the kids. And at the same time, in the middle of this experience, witnessing a lot of the racism and the classism in the school, coming from teachers and administration. I went to Nicaragua during the revolution. Mm-hmm. The Sandinistas had taken over power in 1980, and my own government was basically trying to overthrow the country of Nicaragua. So I kind of put all these things together and saw that the racism in this country was connected to a larger imperialistic quest, really, of the United States historically.
Right, and a larger system of hierarchies. I want to go back to as you began to discover your privilege, it's easier to sympathize or empathize with people who are being pressed down or eliminated or pushed aside. But how did you discover your privilege? What did you become aware of?
Even starting with that fifth grade incident, you know, it was kind of like I was potentially going to stay out of trouble because I was white, plain and simply. Mm-hmm. And, you know, when I say privilege, it's, you know, I'm coming from a lower middle class background. So it's like if my father was a librarian, if he were working now, supporting a family of four, he'd be making $33,000 in today's terms. So, you know, I'm not talking about a great deal of privilege. It's all certainly relative.
You didn't have your
way.
Skin against you.
But I didn't have my skin against me, and I didn't have my gender against me.
Right.
And, you know, my father had a higher education, and my mother didn't get her higher education until her 50s, you know, so that tells a story right there.
Yeah. I have the same sorts of class background, although it was rural farming. Mm-hmm. My fifth grade story is I watched a fifth grade girl, I wanted to call her a young woman because she was the fifth grade feminist and she was not going to take any shit from anybody. Mm. And she let the world know that and she was going to achieve. And she was inspiring to me, and it was my first crush.
Right.
And this was an all-white school in a rural isolated, that was a place that was becoming a rural ghetto as we were living those years from 69 when we were in like fifth grade until we graduated in 76. By the time she graduated, she was engaged, and within a year of graduation, she was married. But she married a man who was a very gentle man, who was an electrician. They had four children together, I think. Yep. She had a life of her making within the constraints that she had to come to terms with. She lost a sister to meningitis because we didn't have proper treatment, health care in that area. Mm-hmm. One in 20 of our peers would die from violence or health care or whatever. We didn't have violence in the school, but we had it outside the school.
Right.
And so that was my kind of trying to figure it out has been a large part of my life.
Right.
And I hear the same in yours. It shapes your commitment.
Right, totally.
Yeah. So how do you hold on to what you're aware of that you cannot change?
How do I hold on to
what you're aware of? Privilege, for example. You still have the privilege. You can still, you know, hold on to it, but you can't change the skin or the gender. How do you carry that awareness into your daily life?
I think it very much informs what I do. I mean, the work that I do, for example, is really about dealing with that privilege. Mm-hmm. And, you know, one of the things that I think for me personally, one of the privileges that I have that I very much value and want to, you know, work to create that in the world is I've got time and space to really reflect on life. You know, I'm an introvert. I like to have space. I like to have flexibility in my life. And I know that a lot of workers and people who are unemployed don't have that time and space to relax. And it just, that feels wrong to me. Mm-hmm. You know, having time with oneself, with one's family. You know, it's just, it's actually evil that people don't have that. Right. So many people in this earth don't have that.
Right. And they don't because and in this country they don't because the poor have to work harder to get further. I realized this past week or the past month or so that the dollar an hour that I made in 1970 when I was 12, which was the minimum wage in Missouri at that point, was the same that my mother made at the same time. But she worked 40 hours a week and I worked 10 to 20. And together I could pay all of my expenses and contribute to the family. And in today's dollars, that would be about $15 an hour each. So between the two of us, we were making $30 an hour when we both worked.
Right.
And that was livable.
Right.
But at half that or less now, a poor kid and his mom can't make it.
Right.
And even if you got four people working, you're barely going to make it.
And that's central to our work at the Worker Center. I'm the director at the Tompkins County Worker Center, and you know, living wage has always been central to our work. And it's just, you know, I think a lot of people listening to the station will agree that it's like the minimum wage should be much different than what it is right now. And you know, it feels like a constant uphill battle.
Right.
So you know, it's like it's not an easy thing to change. And I think we look for victories in small ways locally and hope to expand those into larger victories.
Right. What I am realizing, because one thing that I learned based on this reflection on the minimum wage was that I never realized how high my minimum wage was compared to the minimum wages of kids and adults working nowadays, that it had sunk by over 50% in terms of the loss of value or the wage theft, which is how another way of framing it.
Sure.
And that telling the story in that way is incredibly sobering to people who have no sensitivity to it.
Right.
Otherwise.
I remember in 1977 I was an assistant manager at a fast food restaurant in South Bend, and the minimum wage at that point was $1.85. And you know, it was like, you know, imagine, you know, that would be worth much more than it is now.
And if you lived at home, it was
perfectly paying for
livable.
Rent.
So let's I'm going to go to another piece of your music, and should we go? I'm going to say to Redemption or Comfortably Numb.
Why don't we do Redemption?
Okay. And do you want to say something about that now in your life, or do you want to go to that afterwards?
Well, it's this song was actually in 19. Interestingly, I didn't know the song very well, and I went to a summer camp in 97. I had been a counselor at a summer camp in Connecticut, in New Milford, Connecticut, kind of an artsy camp called Bucks Rock. Camp was actually founded by a student of Freud's like 75 years ago, and just a lot of wealthy people's kids, like Alan Alda's kids, have gone there. Some big name people's kids mm-hmm. go there. It was a really expensive camp, but it was just incredible. I love this camp, and I was like a kid there mm-hmm. as an adult. So there were like counselors from around the world, and there was this one guy from the country of Tanzania in Africa who was there, and we became very good friends. He was a soccer person at mm-hmm. at the camp, and he played the guitar, and I sing actually, and we did this. There's like this talent show, and there's like 400 people at this talent show, and we performed this song, Redemption Song, together, and it was just, we brought the house down with it. And wow. I just always loved the song, and you know, especially the line, emancipate yourselves from mental slavery, none but ourselves can free our minds. Yep. Just love that song, and you know, really, that's kind of like my spiritual mantra these days.
Yep.
So
yep.
Here's Redemption Song.
And that was Bob Marley and Redemption Song. And our guest on this hour of the Made of Clay Report is Pete Myers. Pete, one of the things that I ask people about, just to kind of get to know, because so many people of the 70,000 semi-permanent residents, or maybe 60,000 really permanent residents here, probably half of them didn't start here, or maybe even three quarters of them didn't start here. So what brought you here and what keeps you here in Ithaca?
Well, if you don't mind, I'm going to actually start with 3 years before.
Sure. I mean, it's a process. Moving is a process.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. I actually moved back to South Bend, Indiana in late 1993 and got a job. I had actually been a war tax resister since 1990. For actually 20 years, I didn't pay any federal taxes because I disagreed with how the government was spending the money, especially militarily. And that actually made it difficult for me to stay in New York City at that right. point. So I moved back to South Bend, moved in with my father, and I had my girlfriend with me at the time, Charlotte, who was from Brooklyn. Mm-hmm. And I got a job in the library almost right away, partially because of my privilege as related to my father, who was mm-hmm. who was working in the library. He's not the one who hired me, but the University of Notre Dame was doing a study and commissioned the South Bend Public Library to create a Readmobile project. A Readmobile is like a large bookmobile.
Travels around.
Yeah. But this was very specific, and part of the point of the study was that if kids don't read by third grade, mm-hmm. that they're probably not going to read at all in their lives, and that has a lot to do with literacy rates. So, you know, it's, you know, just like Ithaca, South Bend has a certain incredibly literate population, but a lot mm-hmm. of, actually much more poverty than Ithaca does in South Bend.
Well, it's a larger city.
100,000 people.
And we're a county of 100,000. I don't know what the county is there.
Right.
But we have pushed ours. The poor people here have largely moved out of the county, and they're living outside the county.
Right, because it's cheaper. So I got this job as the director of the Readmobile, and it was a very high-profile project, and I had to this Readmobile was going to focus on inner-city elementary schools. Mm-hmm. And I think partly I got the job because I had been a drug counselor in a Brooklyn high school, and people thought that I had experience. And, you know, and I also knew a lot of the people at the library. I was a known mm-hmm. quantity, in a sense. And I had to hire two assistants, and it came down to, and the director of the entire library system was part of this interview process, and I had to, we interviewed a bunch of people, and it came down to a white male, an associate's degree was required for the job, and experience with kids, and so a white male applied and was one of the two choices, had a PhD but no experience with kids, and worked in a bookstore. And the other candidate was a black male who had worked for 5 years full-time as a substitute in the schools where the Readmobile was going to, and he had an associate's degree. I decided on the black male, especially my experience in New York City, you know, really taught me that kids of, you know, of other than the dominant race mm-hmm, in this mm-hmm. country, white, need to have role models from their own race also involved in their teaching. You know, and we were going to be doing puppet shows and all this stuff and, you know, encouraging kids to read. So I strongly advocated for this black male. The library, the director advocated for the white male. He looked, if there's a stereotypical image of what a librarian looks like, mm-hmm. the white male looked like that. Mm-hmm. The black male did not. I advocated for the black male and very strongly, and I was fired.
Wow.
A month into the job. Mm-hmm. And it just, you know, I was really upset. Both myself and the black male, Tony, decided to take this to the Human Rights Commission, won the case in the Human Rights Commission, but the library turned around and sued the Human Rights Commission. Then we eventually took it to federal court. Actually, he settled, and I went to federal court in late 1999. And basically, my case was
secondary damage.
I was retaliatory discharged mm-hmm. for upholding the rights of a protected person from a protected class. And it went to federal court, a week-long trial, and before an all-white rural Indiana jury, I lost. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And that, you know, kind of, you know, one of the primary things we do at the Tompkins County Worker Center is doing workers' rights. And I think that was like an absolutely defining moment in my mm-hmm. doing that. Mm-hmm. So then I actually, through my war tax resistance work, met Mary Lair, and that was a relationship that initially brought me here mm-hmm. in 2000. And actually, 2 months after I lost that trial, did I come here. Things in the relationship didn't initially work out, and I decided I just hit the ground here running and got a job at Catholic Charities. I actually had the job at Catholic Charities before I even moved here. Mm-hmm. Again, possibly privilege.
Right. Right. And well, yes, but I mean, and that's the funny sort of way. If you are the right progressive here, you are privileged.
Right.
Regardless of color.
Right.
Which is an unfortunate
right.
piece about the progressive niche in this community.
Yeah. Yeah. I actually have a very personal, I won't talk about it right now, but I know that experience very close up and personal.
Yeah. Yeah. So, and what keeps you in Ithaca?
You know, I just, you know,
you've been here for the, you know, middle ages of your life. You know, yeah. You're being here from 40 to 55.
You know, wherever I went to, when I was in New York City, it was just too big, and I felt like I couldn't really find a place there. I mean, it was really involved with stuff, but I couldn't find a place. I moved back to South Bend, you know, my hometown, and, you know, they had this really bad experience, and it was, you know, I didn't really find my place there. And when I moved here, it just, it has always felt like my place has been here.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I don't know why that is. I mean, it's just like I've felt majorly accepted here.
Mm-hmm.
I fit in really well. And, you know, I've been able to take a stand, and people support that, and I support other people's stands. And it just, you know, it's just, I've just never felt at home.
Right.
Like I do here.
Good.
Yeah.
Good, good, good. Now, do you want to say more about, I'd like to hear a little bit about how you've changed.
How I've changed.
How have you changed? I'm kind of doing a radical switch up. We could go to a song if you want to while you think about this one.
I can start.
Okay.
You know, I think that, again, part of it is having moved to Ithaca and just, I remember being in graduate school and learning about Erik Erikson, a psychologist, and he talks about stages of development. And one of the later stages of development is commitment. And I remember really being angry at that when I was in grad school at the age of 23. And, you know, I've always had a problem with commitment. And I feel like with the work that I do here, yeah, I'm occasionally challenged at that, but not really. I mean, it's just, you know, it feels like that's a change I've made where I feel a strong commitment.
Mm-hmm.
And I think also just learning to believe in myself, my spiritual practices of, you know, it's like I really take this seriously what I'm doing,
mm-hmm.
both
mm-hmm.
within myself and without in the world. And I would say that's the biggest change, that it's kind of like I feel settled.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. No, that's neat. That's neat. And to follow the logic of that kind of towards the end, and they posited, and this came later in his later work, there was a notion of wisdom where you can hold on to opposites and not feel like you have to take sides, but you can let the conflict blow through you, which is so much like the first song that you began with.
Right.
Yeah.
It's a constant struggle. I mean, in my work, for example, you know, like advocating for workers' rights and, you know, to change the dynamics of economic injustice, it's, you know, I get
and
tested.
And to humanize the opposition at the
yes,
same time.
Yes, I get tested all the time
yeah.
with that. And, you know, and I, you know, it's like it feels like I've got a lot of stories in my mind. And, you know, the labor movement, you know, both corporate interests and business interests, I mean, historically, many of those interests are like, you know, honestly speaking, trying to keep workers down.
Mm-hmm.
They're trying to keep people down and get as much blood out of a turnip that they can. And by the same token, the labor movement, and I'm, you know, when I say that, I mean both organized labor and unorganized labor, has had sort of a view of enmity towards the people who are oppressing them. I actually find that to be somewhat more understandable, if you will.
Or they don't. I mean, which is that when they're kind of unconscious of what's going on.
Right.
And I think there's a lack of consciousness many times on both sides of the divide, where people are just the managers are just dealing with numbers, and the people living at the bottom are just trying to survive.
Right.
And they're not really conscious of what the conflicts are.
Yeah, and people believe that they don't deserve anymore. Another defining moment in Ithaca is when Walmart opened up here. I think it was 2005, 2006. We did organizing tables all over the county, and I had this young black woman stop at a table. We had a big sign that said, Walmart, pay a living wage. And she was very angry at the sign and wanted to know why we were doing this, because she worked full-time as a cashier at Walmart and was making the minimum wage. I mean, literally like whatever it was at the time, $6.50 an hour. And we had this hour-long discussion with each other, and it really taught me something, and I, you know, that I really needed to engage with her. And I did it very respectfully, and I said, you know, 80 years ago, people were auto workers and being paid sub-minimum wages compared to what we'd be used to now.
Mm-hmm.
And they decided collectively that they were worth more than that. And they organized a union, which we now know as the United Auto Workers. And, you know, I said, you're worth more than that. And we just had this back and forth. She calls me up a month later. She had quit her job at Walmart to find another higher paying job, only a dollar an hour more. But what it taught me
was... A dollar an hour at that rate is 15% wage increase.
Right.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But what it taught me was that, you know, I mean, you know, a lot of us, including myself, you know, we have these grand ideas of social change.
Mm-hmm.
But if we're not actually if we're not actually reaching individuals,
right,
then, you know, and getting their stories, and, you know, it's like there's really not a lot of hope for social change.
Right, right. And That's exactly right. When you know each other's lives as well as you know the scars on the back of your hand and right. and the creases in the front side of the palm of your hand,
right.
then you know your life and you know what people need and what they're getting and what they're not getting.
Right.
That would is where it begins. And one of my only issue with the focus on we have focused so much on monetized labor that we haven't realized that most of our lives are spent in unpaid labor up until the age that I started working at 11 before I could legally work, but most of our lives are always spent, even mine, in unpaid labor.
Mm-hmm.
And many times we have more discretion over how we use our unpaid labor than we use our paid labor.
Right.
Our unpaid labor is how we take care of our bodies.
Right.
It's the primary provider of health care for ourselves in dollar value greater than anything we'll ever pay for.
Right.
By two or three times.
Right.
And we need to have this conversation about how we work our lives
right.
so that we have the money we need, we have the time, which you said before, right. that we need to kind of reflect on it, enjoy
right.
it, and we do the things that are meaningful because
right.
they're the things we're going to do through thick and thin.
Right.
And they're the fabric of our lives. And I'm preaching, so anyway.
Nicely put.
Anyway, you're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca. Pete Myers is our guest on this hour, and I'm going to suggest that we shift to another piece of music. And Dust in the Wind or Comfortably Numb? Do they speak to issues or
Well, you
times?
Know what? Maybe Get Up, Stand Up does.
Okay.
Right?
Well, this is where we're going right now. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Okay. Another Bob Marley.
Stand up for your right. Get up, stand up.
That was Bob Marley and Get Up and Stand Up. And Don't Give Up Your Rights. One of the things that we've been talking about is how have you learned to appreciate? I mean, you just used it with the example with the African American woman at Walmart, but perhaps one of the things that I ask people, and it's a hard question, is how have you learned that something you thought was valuable really wasn't? Or how have you realized that something that you were originally committed to was misguided in a significant way? That may or may not be a question that resonates. I've also asked it in this way: how have you grown suspicious of something you once held kind of as fundamental and true? How have you had to kind of modulate your commitment back off of
that? That's a really great. You got some great questions here, Eric.
These are not easy questions.
For many years, I was a war tax resister, as I mentioned. Mm-hmm. And you know, I think that was an important movement to me at the time, because it's like, you know, it's thinking of Gandhi. It's like about withholding our life energy from a system that we think is oppressive. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And I think I really had to back down from that also, because I felt like my organization was at risk because of my tax resistance. But also in terms of, you know, I actually, by moving here and doing this work, I actually made a switch in terms of the issue that I was organizing on, because I saw this war tax resistance was never going to become like a big movement. You weren't going to have a lot of people putting their livelihoods on the line. I mean, you're taking a real risk by being a war tax resister, because you can have your wages garnished, you can have your house taken away, right, if you have a house, right. All those things. And most people aren't going to risk that. And it, you know, I kind of basically saw that we need to start where people are at. Mm-hmm. So I really made this switch once I actually moved to Ithaca, mm-hmm. and realizing there's a lot of poverty here, there's a lot of working class people that, you know, we oftentimes don't see. And, you know, that's what led to the creation of initially the Tompkins County Living Wage Coalition, which then became the Worker Center, is a way to reach out to people. You know, so I think that was a big switch for me to, you know, and I still value war tax resistance, right, and support, right, the effort, but it's not something that most people were going to be able to do.
Right, right. I worked for a man who was a supporter of the war tax resistors, a pastor in Chicago, on the south side of Chicago, in the late 1960s. In fact, the riots in 68 were organized from the basement of his church, unbeknownst to him. Those riots brought him and his church under investigation. Mm-hmm. They found the account that he'd been putting the money in, because he hadn't been paying taxes, but he had not been spending it. Mm-hmm. He had been putting it off in another account. That account was found and then completely seized, right, and removed. Yeah. So he did. He made his protest, but he did not win in the end, because even in 1968, they had the means to find him.
Right. Right.
Yeah. Wow. Wow. It's that's pretty intense. Pretty powerful. Those are you know, when you, it's always a choice between doing something that's exemplary and doing something that people can really engage. And we're also tempted in this. And this is the money issue too. Again, mm-hmm. one of the lessons that I learned in seminary was, you can organize for money, or you can organize for feet. You want to follow the money, because that's what in society really works. But in community, where people relate to each other's lives, you want to see where they spend their time, where they walk with their feet, mm-hmm. and you want to organize for feet.
Right.
And people can do all sorts of damage to you materially or financially, but if you have their feet with you, then they find ways to survive,
right,
even through the hard times. But there are very few people who are going to be tax resistors, because it's going to challenge those ties. Very few people are going to be whistleblowers either. It's the same kind of role.
Right.
And I spent a fair amount of my adult life reflecting on that.
Right.
Most whistleblowers never work in their career again once they've blown the whistle. And many of them have serious marital or family problems, because it puts such a strain. Mm-hmm. It's not what people signed up for.
Right.
So if you're going to do that, you have to make sure all of your people are with you before you take the first step.
Right.
Because once you go down that step,
right,
there are lots of consequences.
Right. You know, I think looking at that question, I mean, I think that, and this has been a hard one. You know, I think I imagined myself even up to 10 years ago, being a revolutionary, mm-hmm, in mm-hmm. essence.
And it's fun, especially when you come from next to nothing or very little, to imagine taking on the system and winning.
And I think, you know, that's still very much there for me, but what I've realized, there was a certain element in that I was not taking care of myself. Mm-hmm. And I don't mean necessarily physically, partially that too, but, you know, just taking care of like my own soul, mm-hmm. and, you know, and healthy relationships and all that. And it's kind of like, it's not an either or thing. And I'm not going to do it all myself. You know, I come from a background where if it's going to get done, I've got to do it myself.
Yeah. But the thing that damages your soul is that if we have to win at the expense of anybody else, we're just bullies.
Right.
Like the rest.
Right.
And so our job is not to win the fight. It's to stop the fight.
Yeah.
And help everybody
to be humanized in the process.
And move on. And everybody get what they need.
Right.
Because
I can't help but think of a lot of the oppression that goes on in the world and in our community in whatever form. It's like the people wouldn't do that oftentimes to their own families.
Right.
That's so part of the vision here is how do we realize we're all part of this one family?
How do we refamiliarize?
Yeah.
Refamiliize ourselves.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. And in that sense, we have to be able to look across differences of race and class. And I know I'm saying this as a white guy with an elite education, but I also know the roots that are otherwise. And I'm not cashed in on that too much in my life.
Right.
But we have to be able to look at each other and figure out, what can we do together? I don't necessarily like you or even trust you, but I'm going to say we're going to be better together if we work together than if we don't work together.
Right. Right.
I think what we're getting at here is a quality of humility that often doesn't get talked about.
Yeah.
And I just want to. How have you, you know, when you give up the fight, so to speak, and you're talking about giving up the kind of the revolutionary in you, it's appealing, but. It doesn't work.
Well, I think it still can work, but it's in a different.
It almost always produces almost as much bullying as it overcomes.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to make your enemies your friends, or they're going to take you down the road.
Right.
You know.
Yeah.
If you with the long view.
Right.
And so how have you come to terms with commitment and humility?
I can see it in two different ways. One is, I think, you know, I've got an ego like everybody else mm-hmm. does. And I think earlier on in my organizing work, there was an element of my wanting to be out on the front lines. In terms of media exposure, in mm-hmm. terms of like, this is me doing this, mm-hmm. in a sense. Mm-hmm. And while I certainly have had a need for that for whatever reason, you know, to affect the change that we want to affect. It's necessarily takes a lot of people to be a part of that.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, so that's one element of it. Also, you know, it's interesting. My partner of present time, mm-hmm. Gina is actually, works in the human resources field. Which has been tremendously interesting because if you think about what my work is now, it's as labor. It's like, you know, I'm also
labor as a human resource.
And also, I'm the HR director at the Tompkins County Worker Center, quite frankly. But it's like, you know, there's an element of where we can kind of go to this place where, you know, like we're opposing corporate HR mm-hmm. in a sense. But, you know, I mean, the thing is, we have, you know, if we're not trying to reform or like work with people to change how HR is sometimes practiced,
right.
And you know, it's not always bad. Mm-hmm. You know, it's about how do we treat our workers most mm-hmm. humanely. So it's like, you know, I've had enough. We've done a lot of grassroots stuff here at the Worker Center. I remember we did this. I'm not going to mention any names here, but a number of years ago, you know, like 6 years ago, we did this. We got the Department of Labor to do a sweep of restaurants, mm-hmm. 25 mm-hmm. restaurants down, and it. Unfortunately, they did it all around the commons, so everybody thought that the Worker Center had ordered this. And there was a particular restaurant owner, name unmentioned, who was very angry at this because this person's restaurant was kind of targeted for like a really low-level thing. There was one restaurant that was $45,000 worth of wage theft, but there was another restaurant where one of the people hadn't been properly registered as a minor working in the restaurant. and this person's restaurant was listed in the same vein as, you know, the $45,000 worth of wage theft. And I really have gotten to know this person, and it's like, yeah, you were totally right, and we were kind of coming on strong here. And, you know, all situations are complicated in that mm-hmm, sense.
Mm-hmm. Yep, yep.
And these are all local businesses, so, you know, I mean, it's not... Yeah, I could go on and on.
No, and but that is also, that is your life, and right. and it's been a big part of it. One of the things that I'm going to want to switch now to another song, and I kind of was headed there, but maybe, why did you pick Dust in the Wind?
You know, I think it helps me to, I've always loved the song, but mm-hmm. it, you know, grows on me every day because, you know, it feels like I take myself very seriously. Mm-hmm. And I in my better moments, I kind of like, wow, you take yourself kind of seriously here, dude. And I see other people taking themselves seriously. And you know what? Frankly, we're really not much more than dust in the wind.
Right. And that's why I was transitioning to the humility piece. And this is, mm-hmm. this is humus. The word humus is the basis of humility.
Right.
And we are dust in the wind. And so that's where we're going to go now.
Cool.
You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and our guest on this hour is Pete Myers, and that was Kansas and Dust in the Wind. And the Dust in the Wind piece was to kind of be the great leveler And if you've lived where there is a lot of dust in the wind, you feel it in your eyes, you feel it in your body, you clean it out of your house. I would watch the cars go by the front yard of my house in Missouri, 30 miles from Kansas, and the dust would roll off the dirt road, the gravel road, and you could watch it waft its way through the screen and then onto the floor. And some days that just watching the physics and the art and the beauty of that was enough, and it was very leveling and very healing. And believe you me, I have had few times in my life where I could just sit and watch and appreciate and not take myself so seriously.
Right.
And that's very powerful what you were saying before.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. About learning to not take yourself so seriously, even though what we do, it matters.
Right.
It matters, but it's not the only thing that matters.
Right.
One of the way I like to kind of bring these interviews to a close is to ask, what is it that you do to sustain yourself? What do you do on a daily basis, weekly basis, regular basis to kind of rejuvenate your mind and your heart and your body?
Well, it's becomes absolutely central to me to meditate. Wake up every morning, and I meditate for an hour in the morning and attempt to bring that into my, just in a certain sense, I'm meditating right now as we talk.
Sure.
You know, it's about being present.
Right.
That's
right.
What meditation is.
Right. And when you say you're meditating while we talk, you're being present. How is it that you handle your engagement with we? How is it that you manage yourself that's different because you're meditating while we talk as opposed to something else?
Great question. You know, I'm present to my breath as we talk. I'm, you know, it's on one level it's work and one level it's letting go of work, but it's also I'm present to you.
Right.
I'm present to the relationship.
We're making solid eye contact.
We're making solid eye contact. You know, it's, you know, I'm letting go of my sense of separation from you, in a sense. But it's also dealing with, you know, whatever, oh, there's this guy over there, Eric. I'm Pete over here. And it's kind of, you know, dealing with all the fears, all the worries, all the joys, and you know, just realizing it still comes down to the present moment right here, right now. And that the breath is so, you know, so absolutely important. You know, I'm not alive in this body without this breath, for example.
Right, and the breath has a rhythm that in itself is comforting, even if the fear doesn't completely go away.
Right, and there's no grand place to get to, but it's actually just being with our experience right here, right now. And in some ways, you know, as committed as I am in the world to what I do, this is like a place that I actually really want to explore, is like, you know, I think helping people to get in touch with themselves and with their stories, as you are doing with this show, is so important in their hearts, our hearts.
Right. So they can be fully present to each other.
Right.
Yeah. An hour meditation, a sense of presence in conversation and when you're with each person during the day. And what else do you do?
Well, I'm a jogger. You know, I'll be going 7 miles tomorrow. I
often see you running the streets and hills of Ithaca.
And I'm also a smoker. I'm proud to say, and I'm being facetious, I haven't missed a day in 32 years. So I smoke organic tobacco, American Spirit. It's not a plug for American Spirit. And I also do yoga. And then the relationship that I'm in is a very powerful relationship, and I think it's about heart. And that's an interesting experience for me. You know, it's kind of like I've kind of grown up. My life, I would actually say, has been very numbing in a certain way. You know, I don't know how unusual that is or not.
Right, right.
But, you know, there's a lot of ways in which I've been numb to myself. And, you know, oftentimes when I become present to myself, I realize, like, wow, I've got a lot of contraction going on within myself.
How could I have lived out of touch for so long?
Yeah.
I suddenly see.
Well, I think that there's something about this society that kind of encourages people to do that. It's, you know, the consumeristic society that we are is like, you know, buy this, buy that in order to make yourself feel better.
Right. When you've realized your numbness and you begin to come out of it, what is that? How do you notice? How do you kind of unwind or open up? Not so contract. Numbness, I sense, is kind of contraction or
extreme contraction in a certain sense.
Like you've clenched your fist to the point where you can no longer feel, or you've held yourself so tight until you can no longer feel.
So it really is, I think part of it is really just being with that. mm-hmm. being with the absolute contraction, the numbness, and just, you know, just allowing it to be what it is, not trying to change it, you know, but continuing to breathe, and it actually starts mm-hmm. to change on its own. But the more I try to control it and change it myself, you know, it's an interesting, what is the role in that, mm-hmm. our role mm-hmm. in that. But I mean, it's, what is relaxation? If you try to relax, does that work?
It may start you, but if you continue to be conscious of it, it won't.
Right.
And most of these disciplines, we learn them consciously, and maybe you even practice them on a daily basis, mm-hmm. like you're talking about, as a discipline. But there comes a time when we have to let go of the discipline and just see if it emerges spontaneously in our life.
Right.
And then we'll know that we've really learned it.
Right.
Yeah. We're gonna end this interview in a kind of unusual way today, because the song that we comfortably numb from The Wall, which was probably, I don't know, it wasn't the biggest, it may have been the second biggest Pink Floyd album.
Now, let me just say a little bit about it. It's actually it was in 19, oh boy, I think the movie came out in 81 or 82. This was made into a movie, The Wall, and I actually have seen it 15 times. And it actually, in some ways, I think it speaks to the human condition, but it actually speaks to a young male's mm-hmm. condition.
And specifically that transition between Vietnam and,
right.
and the Iraq and Iran, whatever.
Right. Yeah. And just the alienation that kind of, you know, how do we build up walls around ourselves? And this is a particular story mm-hmm. of a particular wall that somebody develops. And I kind of really identified with that. You can start to play it underneath me. You know, so I ask us all to think as we hear this song, like, what do we do to, you know, how are we comfortably numb, and how can we allow ourselves to wake up?
And I'm going to speak over this. This has been the Made of Clay Report with Pete Myers. Pete, it has been wonderful to get to know you this morning.
It has been great, Eric, and I really appreciate the shows that you had. I appreciate being on your show today, but I think I would like
You can go and find them at madeofclay.org if you want to hear your past shows, and I encourage all of our listeners to also give feedback and suggestions of additional people to interview.
Sounds good.
And we'll leave you with Comfortably Numb, with the hope that it's an inspiration to address that issue. Listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and that concludes the Made of Clay Report for this Sunday.